when you look around the landscape, things are starting to look a little bizarre. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
It's great to be back with you, Barry, here in the studio. I'd say with your headliner that you are the master of understatement. Indeed. Things are a little bizarre out there right now. And as we go along, it's getting more and more bizarre. But again, those of us who have done studies into Christian worldview and have followed people, presuppositionalists, and people who have a Christian philosophy as applied to life in general, the faith for all of life crowd, if you will, could explain why that we knew this has been coming for quite some time. And the reason it has been coming for quite some time is that here in the West, not just in the United States of America, but in the West, and by that I mean the Christian or formerly Christian West, we have been separating ourselves as rapidly and as completely as we can from God and his plan for our lives and how we should live them for decades, if not centuries. This thing goes back further than anybody thinks. You know, one of the arguments that we have gotten into about whether the United States was founded on Christian principles or not, and that's what we mean by the idea of America being a Christian nation. It's not that everybody who's born here is automatically a Christian. There is no such thing as that. There is no birthright citizenship in the kingdom of heaven. There is only membership in the kingdom of heaven through the auspices of Jesus Christ, our King. But what we mean is that the underpinning, the philosophies that the United States of America was founded on was the Christian faith. Does that mean that everybody involved in the founding of the United States of America was a Christian? Well, I would point out one person, David Barton's arguments notwithstanding, and that would be Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson was most definitely not a Christian. He was a Unitarian, he had a Christian worldview. Now, what does that mean, this Christian worldview thing? Well, one of his chief mentors was a guy named George Wythe. This is the man whose feet he sat at and who educated him and taught him how not just the legal profession, but a lot of life works, which he adopted a great deal of. And George Wythe was a very devout Christian. If you ever spend time in Colonial Williamsburg, make sure you go by the George Wythe House. Now, you're not going to get any... Yeah, you'll get some talk about him, but you can visit George Wythe's house, where it's just down the street from William & Mary University. It's within half a mile of William & Mary, and that's where Thomas Jefferson went to college. And that's where he came under the mentorship of George Wythe, but he's not the only one who was there. Was George Washington a Christian? The answer is yes. Was he completely Orthodox? Well, that's in question. Nonetheless, he had the Christian worldview inculcated into him. How so? Through being educated, and you'll find most of these guys were educated at home, so the faith would be passed from father to son and mother to daughter, and that being said, then they would go off to places like William & Mary and other schools that were run by the church. One of the things you run into when you look at the founding of the United States of America was that, for instance, the alma mater of a lot of the founders would have been a lot of the Ivy League schools, Harvard. Harvard, for instance, Harvard was a Unitarian institution after 1805. They had abandoned the Trinitarian viewpoint of Christianity and gone over to a Unitarian viewpoint. which means that Jesus Christ was a wonderful person and not the the Son of God and not the second member of the Godhead. That has a profound influence on how things the world is viewed. And that being said, Harvard has long since divorced itself from its church origins. And now, you know, if you mention Jesus Christ on campus, you'll get laughed off the place. So that is the inevitable result of subtracting yourself from the roles of Christian influence. And what we're witnessing is exactly that. We are witnessing the result of walking away from our first love, from doing what Psalm 2 says for the princes of the world to do, and that is kiss the king lest he be angry. And the king is understandably getting angry, and we are having our blessing withdrawn. So there's my rant for the morning.
No, well, that's fine. Frankly, there's a lot to be ranting about. You know, you and I were talking as we were looking over the landscape here as we get prepared to do this program. And of course, you know, we could talk about all the things that are happening in D.C. with the president's agenda. We certainly do want to talk a little bit at some point here during the program about the current blockade of trying to repeal the Obamacare mess and why Ohio is playing prominently in that, sadly. But really, the thing that caught our attention the most was a report that's coming out of Florida. And, you know, as you and I looked at this, we basically are sitting here just somewhat flabbergasted at the lack of common civility, I guess would be the lowest level to say, or probably more accurately is the lack of any kind of moral framework that seems to be being inculcated into our future generations. Because this is a report, Chuck, you know, is coming out of Florida, specifically the Cocoa, Brevard County, Florida, around the Cocoa Beach area. And basically, it's an article about the death of a 32-year-old mentally challenged individual who happened to drown in an accident when he went into a pond and ended up not being able to swim or maybe got caught in muck or something at the bottom of the pond and couldn't get out, and he drowned. And no, that particular part isn't the whole lack of civility and morality. It's the key problem that there were three teenagers on the bank of the lake who videotaped with their phones this man's death. They filmed him struggling and drowning and refused to do anything. As a matter of fact, they didn't even report it. It took the authorities 3 days to find the body of this man. Now, this was a man who was disabled, mentally disabled. And these three teenagers, the only way they figured out about it was because they posted the video, and when they caught their voices talking about it and laughing at the man and saying derogatory things to him as he's drowning, they were able to track the teens down. Now, that's basically what happened is these three decided to post, they thought it was so cool that they decided to post it up on their social media. Chuck, I sat here and even reading this again, I get a cold feeling in my gut when you think about the fact that we're growing up a generation that doesn't care. I mean, that basically watching someone struggle and die, they don't have any problem with that. But I guess I shouldn't be surprised because, you know, these kids are being brought up in an environment with, you know, and of course you can blame violent video games, we can blame all this, we can blame media, but really they're being brought up in an environment where we've basically told them, well, you know, you guys are the survivors because, well, you didn't get aborted. And it's okay to kill someone who's defenseless or let them die because they don't have value to you or they won't have a good quality of life. And so therefore, well, you know, why not?
Yeah, it's okay
honestly,
to kill them.
I'm starting to believe that these teenagers are just reflecting the worldview that they've been handed.
Okay. I don't see how you can avoid that viewpoint. First of all, I'm going to tell you that the Florida police say teens who filmed and taunted a drowning man did not break any laws. I'm going to be quite honest. I doubt that. I don't.
Right. Well, and there's the whole thing right there, folks. I mean, that's the reason why this is so. This is getting into the Twilight Zone. The law enforcement basically are giving these three a pass. I mean, they stood and watched this guy screaming and calling for help and refused to do anything. But for some reason, and I don't know the way some Florida law is written, Chuck.
I don't either.
But you're right. Law enforcement saying, well, you know, they didn't violate the Good Samaritan law. How could they not have done that?
Yes. How could they not? There is a criminal act that's a wanton disregard for human life. Now, whether it's written into Florida law or not, I don't know. But if it's not, then it should be. Because this is an act of depravity. When the teenagers were actually tracked down who did this, they said at least one showed absolutely no remorse. Well, I think if you were to question this person closely, what you would find out is that you would get a retort, and pardon me for using this phrase, he was just a retard. That kind of sentiment has a lot wrapped up with it. What it says is that human beings, even those who are damaged or have developmental disabilities and that kind of thing, are not created in the image of God. I think you would find out that this person, whoever he may be, this teenager who has expressed no remorse, completely has that attitude. In fact, if you asked him if human beings carry the image of God, he said he would tell you there is no God, and he would laugh. Or he'd say, not the God I worship. Or not the God I know of. And he would go off and give you some weird philosophy regarding, you know, evil white people. And in fact, unfortunately, this poor man was black or Hispanic. He was a dark-skinned individual, let's put it that way. And there may be an element of that in there. Because, let's face it, one of the things that allowed people of color to be abused and treated poorly for centuries was the idea that somehow they were less of a human. They weren't as advanced. They weren't. They had not. If you would, they have not evolved. Now remember, we know Charles Darwin, and it goes back to around 1857. But that idea of evolution goes back way, way, way further than that. One of the ways that, for instance, chattel slavery in the United States of black individuals was allowed to stand is because of the philosophy that somehow they weren't as advanced as we were. Adopting a we and them rather than us attitude.
Right.
And the fact is that these kids do not understand the idea that all human beings carry the image of God. And what does that mean? That means you don't wantonly kill them. Are there situations where you may have to kill someone? Yes, there are. If someone is trying to kill you, someone who doesn't have the idea, let's say that you are a Christian and you have the idea of marrying the image of God, and someone comes along who does not carry that image and decides that you can be killed for whatever reason, robbery or hatred due to racial things, or hatred over the fact that you drive a nicer car than they do, or hatred over the fact that you may have money that they don't have, or whatever. They decide to kill you. Do you have the right to defend your life? And the answer is yes, you do. Does the state have the right to end the life of someone who has shown a wanton disregard for your freedom and your life? And the answer is, yes, they do. And it comes from the authority that God gives the magistrate to essentially act in his stead. And what has God said the penalty for things like kidnapping and rape and murder are? He has said it's death. Now, you'll hear a lot of arguments about how, well, the state committing murder is just as bad as the individual who commits murder. Well, it's not murder when you apply the death penalty and you apply it fairly as the result of a trial with a proper number of witnesses and can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that someone has done this. The requirement for the death penalty in the Bible was two or three witnesses who actually saw the event. There are some who argue that irrefutable forensic evidence is one of those witnesses, and I would fall into that camp. Blood, DNA, that kind of thing. But this is the whirlwind. When we sowed the wind, we are now reaping the whirlwind. By walking away from the basis of morality, we now see what happens when you walk away from the basis of morality. You begin to breed members of society who are amoral. And you can't go back and argue morality with them because, as far as they're concerned, without God, it's arbitrary. And that is
entirely up to them. It becomes autonomous.
Exactly, it's autonomy.
Morality is what they want, and so you can have these young people who basically said, and I quote, and this is out of the article. Now, first of all, I want to make a slight correction. I apologize. An original article that I read on this said that the man was, when they said disabled, they said was, you know, developmentally disabled. But there's an update on Florida Today where it says that he was physically disabled. So there was a mistake there earlier, and that he walked with a cane. So he had a physical disability. So once he got in the pond, he couldn't get out because he was physically disabled. But while he's in there struggling, and this quote says that the teenagers, as they're filming them, are saying things like, "Get out of the water, you're going to die." And another yelled, says, "Ain't nobody fixing to help you, you dumb blank." And they, of course, they block out that word, and it's hard to tell what that word might be, but it, you know, that could have been a racial epithet.
Yeah, it could have been.
And so seconds later, Dunn could be heard yelling. Then his head disappeared beneath the water one last time. And on the videotape, you can hear one of the teens saying, "Oh, he just died."
Yeah.
And then they laughed, and then they left. And again, it wasn't until over the weekend, Jamel Dunn is the dead man. He was 32 years old. It was 3 days before the authorities realized where he was when this video was posted on social media.
Right.
I mean, that's, folks, you know, this is a situation, and these weren't young kids. These were 14 to 16-year-old teenagers. And frankly, they said when they, you know, after they found the body and then they figured out who these kids were and they brought them into the police station, that basically, at the very least, one of them really just didn't show any remorse whatsoever and just was smirking and just didn't care. They just, for them, it was an entertaining afternoon of something to distract them. So, I mean, that's really what it gets down to.
Yeah.
It broke across of being just interesting enough for them that they filmed it, made jokes about it, and posted it up on social media like it was something cool. Now, I don't know. You can't speak for anybody, Chuck. And oftentimes we can't even really speak for ourselves until we're in a situation. But I know for me, and then probably speaking for you as well, if we were at a pond and somebody was thrashing about and screaming for help, I think we try to do something, anything we could, even if at the very least it was get on the cell phone and call for the authorities, you know, or for a rescue squad or something to come and help. You would do something. You know, I'd hope that, you know, my kids are, you know, in that and a little bit above that age range of these three teenagers. I would certainly hope that they would do more than pull out their phones and start videotaping and then taunting and, you know, cajoling the person while they watch them die. And, well, and I honestly think, and I can report pretty well, my kids have a biblical worldview. They would do something.
Yes.
You know, I don't have any fear of that. Let's put it this way. But I am starting to fear, Chuck, because more and more you see these incidences where, you know, groups of teenagers are going out and, you know, they'll just accost some stranger on the street and pummel them and beat them to a pulp, or they'll, you know, engage in acts of violence. And again, let's point back, it's not just the media that they're involved in, even though you've got movies like the Purge series. And, you know, and you have violent video games like your Grand Theft Autos and everything else, which basically glorifies this type of amoral or immoral behavior. But really what it gets down to is there's no moral center. There's no right and wrong. There's no standard of accountability that's being inculcated in these in young people. And that's happening not just at school, not just with their peers, but most cases it's happening in their homes. You know, in many cases, you may be a child who knows that you might have had a couple of other siblings had they not been aborted. Or you may be in a situation where the value of family has been basically brought to zero, because there's no father in the family, or the mother's abandoned the family, or you've been orphaned through no choice of your own, and not through death, but basically maybe through the whole idea of imprisonment of the family members. These are the environments that are breeding this type of callous disregard and remorselessness that we're seeing. Now, again, and I don't want to necessarily use this point as saying that that's indicative of everybody, because there are a lot of good teenagers out there who'll do the right thing.
Yes,
I mean,
yeah,
you know, as we're here in Ohio and other places, and even in Florida, you know, right now we've got lots of teenagers who are doing things like going to their county fair and, you know, showing animals and doing all sorts of things or volunteering in service over the summer or doing, you know, missions work or working in you know, communities, doing all sorts of things that are beneficial. And so I don't want to necessarily paint like a complete brush, but these are symptoms of a longer-term lingering disease, and
right.
we have to recognize this, because if you don't know what the symptoms are and you don't know what the real disease is, there's no way to accurately treat it. You can try a bunch of Band-Aid things like midnight basketball or, you know, after school programs and things of that nature. But really, and I heard, you know, I sat and talked with a politician the other day whose great idea were, you know, we got to do something about the golden hours, you know, from between 3 and 8 the next morning. And, you know, we got to do so. And I'm thinking to myself, government can't create enough, you know, involvement without the whole idea of morality.
Yes,
you can't. There's no program you're going to come up with, or no diversion you're going to come up with that will best the tempting nature of sin in someone who doesn't have a moral basis to stand on.
Well, okay, it brings up the
or who doesn't understand a moral basis.
It brings up the concept of ethics. What is ethics?
Well, yes.
Yeah, what is ethics? We hear that term thrown around a lot. What exactly is ethics? Ethics is the application of morality. Okay. It all depends on what your morality is based on, what your ethic will be. Okay? Think about this. We have begun to adopt a morality which allows for the killing of human beings, because, one, they're inconvenient, or they would be less than perfect, or name a number of reasons. They're not wanted at the moment. They would cause economic hardship in our family. There are scads and scads and scads of excuses why killing a human being would be ethical. We have explained, we just went through a scenario. We just explained this, how it would be ethical to kill another human being. If your body or your freedom was in danger of being taken by someone else, it is perfectly ethical for you to defend yourself from that. Now, we have ethics, moral ethic based on a creator God turned on its head in certain places, in certain cities, in certain states, where you may not, under any circumstances, take the life of an individual who is coming to do you great harm. But you may take the life of an individual because they have become inconvenient or become a burden to you. Now, we're getting ready to go into that particular thing from two ends. That particular, killing someone who's a burden or who's imperfect or is just simply unwanted, from both ends of the life spectrum. At the beginning, in the form of an abortion, and at the end, in the form of euthanasia. A lot of people want to just take people who have lived their useful lives, quote unquote, into a recycling center, if you will, and have them killed. You can see this in places like the Netherlands. And Barry, you gave a we put up after last week's show, we put up a link to a place. Perhaps you can remind me of the name real quick. I wrote the link. I can't remember the name of the.
Parents Resource Council?
No, it was
Patients Resource
Council. Patients Resource Council, yeah, the Patients Resource right. Council. And basically, they go into stories to explain what's going on in some of these cases. For instance, we talked last week about the Charlie Gard situation. Charlie Gard situation is a perfect example. We have the ability to keep this child alive and possibly long enough for a some kind of treatment for him to be developed. And yet... the powers that be in England have decided that this child needs to die, and he needs to do so he doesn't become a burden on the system. And in fact, what this has become a fight over is control. There's also a PR issue, a public relations issue involved in that. If the United States, that still has some, we still have some pinning on a free market economy, even in the healthcare field. Barry and I can testify to you that we can still negotiate prices for things for being self-pay or being on a program that covers expenses after you have negotiated the best price. So they can't have the idea that this child would be killed under a national healthcare system because he's nothing but a potential burden versus a free enterprise system or the vestiges of a free enterprise system where that child will be kept alive long enough to see if something will work. Why is that? Well, that child's value has gone to very close to zero under the national healthcare scenario.
Correct.
And he still has value in the free enterprise scenario. And if you don't think that's fair, I'm sorry. That's the way it is. This is an ethical dilemma. And it would be ethical for them over there to just simply allow the child to die. It's still unethical over here. And the fact is, that is a direct consequence of the adoption of the socialized medicine ethic, because that's what it is. It's an ethic, and it has a morality. What is the morality? The old and infirm and damaged must die in order to provide proper care for those who remain healthy. Once those individuals become unhealthy, they go onto the trash heap. They have a duty to die, not a right to die. And don't be fooled by the idea that you have you have the right to die with dignity. That is a buzz phrase for you have the duty to die as quickly as possible and not be a burden. That's what we're dealing with here. That's how the ethic is shifting. How is it that the Bible treats people who are old and infirm and imperfect? It says they bear the image of God and that they have the right to go on to their natural death. Now, what does that mean? Again, we have, if we just withdraw medical treatment, they'll just die. That's the whole point. God has allowed us the ability to go in and find treatments and find things that prolong our life and find things that reduce our pain. He has allowed us, he has given us the brains and guided us and allowed us to find those things. And now we're saying, we want them to die a natural death. And so we're going to withdraw all these things that God has given us on the basis that, the room needs to be made for the healthy so that the unhealthy must go to save the assets of the healthy. No, that's not the way this works. And in fact, societies prove what they're made of by how they treat the infirm and the imperfect and the burdensome. That's how we show what we're made of.
That's true. And right now, that's not looking so good.
No, that's looking really bad. It's looking really bad. This is sort of what's going on in Congress right now when we're talking about repealing Obamacare. Because, folks, this is exactly the argument for the repeal of Obamacare. Because you might say, you're using a logical fallacy. You're using a slippery slope argument. Okay, it's not a logical fallacy when you are already in headlong slide down the slope. And we are in headlong slide down the slope.
That's true. Chuck, if you don't mind, I want to kind of back up just a quick second because I want to attach something on to that riff you just had right before we start talking about the Obamacare issue. You had mentioned the whole issue with Charlie Gard because, we had been discussing that. Last week's program was all about that. There's been some updates, and I think that it's very interesting because there has been a softening, I guess you might say, with the judge who initially ruled for the hospital because Gard's family's attorneys had wanted to have another hearing because they had new evidence, and their new evidence were the results of a number of experimental research studies that had been done here in the U.S. on children with similar but maybe not quite as fully developed type of mitochondrial disease that this baby has, showing that they have a 56% success rate in improving the condition of the children with this disease. Well, the hospital, obviously they filed an injunction to try to get the judge to not allow that information to be submitted in order to reconsider the decision. And the judge, last Friday, said absolutely not to the hospital. We are going to take that information and we're going to consider it. Well, in the meantime, here in the U.S., there was some action in Congress, and again, it's just some action because it's not, even though some of the media may have been reporting it or shading it like it was a done deal, nothing's ever a done deal in Congress, and that's sort of why we'll talk about the Obamacare thing in a minute. But there was the House passed an amendment to the Homeland Security Appropriations Bill, okay? Just like the National Defense Authorization Act last week, they tried to attach an amendment to stop the funding of gender reassignment surgery for military personnel. This week, it was the Homeland Security budget, their Authorization Act, that's their budget. And Representative Jamie Herrera Butler who is from Washington State, one of the few Republicans from Washington State, introduced an amendment to basically approve Charlie Gard, the baby, and Charlie's parents with permanent U.S. resident status. Now, again, it's a step. It's not a final thing, but if Congress passes the bill, which they're going to because it's the spending measure for the Homeland Security, and if the president signs it, which he most likely will, that means Charlie Gard and his parents are considered permanent U.S. residents, which means then what, Chuck?
Well, residency status gets you a whole lot of stuff. It doesn't get you full citizenship rights, but boy, does it.
No. Nope. But what is it? What is it? What does it specifically get you when you're sitting in England?
Well,
it gets you. Okay, go ahead.
I'm trying to think. When you're sitting in a foreign nation, it basically gets you embassy.
Bingo! That's it. It gets you the U.S. ambassador to England, who can act on your behalf. They're going to put some pressure. They want to put some pressure on Britain, and I think it's a good thing. Now, it's very interesting, though, Chuck, because the representative who brought this particular amendment to the bill, which was overwhelmingly voted in favor of course, she isn't really a stranger to this whole despondent, it's completely, absolutely no-win situation, medical situations with children. Why? Because her daughter, Abigail, and they've got a picture of Herrera Bootler here on the website. She's a young woman. She's probably in her late 30s, okay? Her daughter, Abigail, was born without kidneys.
Oh, gosh.
Doctors here in the U.S. were telling this mom-to-be, who is now a U.S. congresswoman, your daughter can't survive. It's impossible. It's 100% fatal. Well, says here in the article, and this is on LifeSite News, that she and her husband convinced a doctor after much begging, and there's a link about what they did, to inject saline solution into her uterus to help the baby develop properly. Now, this is an interesting thing too, Chuck. Usually when a doctor is injecting saline into a uterus, what's it for?
Abortion.
Saline abortion. Yeah. It's to kill the child. They had saline solution injected into her uterus to help the baby develop properly. The baby was born and lived on dialysis for 3 years until she got big enough that her father donated one of his kidneys to her, and now she's doing okay. She's the first baby born with her condition to survive. So, Representative Jamie Herrera Bootler, speaking from experience of a parent who did everything they knew to do to protect their child and to give them a life when everybody around them in the medical community was saying, let the baby die. 100% fatal. That baby can't survive. Can't do it.
That's called talking the talk and walking the walk.
Exactly. So I think very interesting here that you really are starting to see that it is a major, this is a worldview battle, folks. Do we believe that life is precious in all of its forms, whether it's quote unquote a perfect little baby or whether it's a baby that's got challenges like a mitochondrial DNA issue or a developmental issue where the baby doesn't have kidneys. It really, Chuck, it doesn't get down to the baby's quality of life. It really gets down to what's the underlying worldview, presuppositions of the parents and those around them, and even in the medical community, as to how we value life. Now, it's obvious Charlie Gard's parents value that baby's life very strongly. They did everything they could to seek help when he first started showing signs that something was desperately wrong. They have worked their tails off to research and find where they might be able to get help for their child. They've raised money through Kickstarters and through other GoFundMes, excuse me, not Kickstarter, a GoFundMe page, they have the resources to bring the child to America to get that help. But the ethics panels of the Great Ormond Street Hospital, and folks, if you've ever had a situation with a loved one or anybody else who are in dire medical straits, you're going to run across a hospital ethics panel who their ethic is, how much is it going to cost us?
Exactly. That is the bottom line.
Care for this person.
Yep.
How much is it really going to cost us to continue to provide care for this person? Is the cost-benefit analysis in our favor? That's the real, and that's the problem, and you pointed it out here with Charlie Gard. That's the real reason why the hospital's fighting so hard and trying to legally take away the parents' rights so that this baby will die, because they realize how much it's going to cost the system if Charlie Gard continues to live.
Exactly. Yes,
because in socialized medicine, it's single payer, dude, which means the government's paying for it.
Well, it's not just socialized medicine, because they have a cradle-to-grave welfare system in England, and the chances are that that child would be on the dole for the rest of its life.
And however long that might be.
However long that might be. Some of these kids live up to 12 and a little past. As things currently stand, let's just say, as things currently stand, medical progress continues, except in places that would rather kill off babies than research ways to keep them alive. And that's why free enterprise-based medicine in the United States is way better than socialized medicine in countries like England, Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, places where it's easy to kill off people, stops research into ways to keep them alive.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, and that's interesting, because you're right here where there's more, a little bit more free market, although, you know, we're partially all the way into a socialized medicine scenario anyway with Obamacare, and we're going to get to that in just a second. Dr. Michio Hirano, who's an American doctor, is the doctor who has been performing the experimental procedure. That doctor flew to England last week and was allowed by the court to examine the baby, to examine Charlie Gard. And he basically has said that his treatment could have an 11 to 56% chance of bringing meaningful improvement to Charlie's condition. Now, Chuck, if you're a parent and a doctor tells you that there's an 11% chance that a experimental treatment is possibly going to improve your child's health outcomes when the only other outcome is death, you going to take that chance?
You bet I'll take it in a New York minute.
Of course, we're all going to do that. But you can't do it if you live in a country with socialized medicine where the hospital ethics panel tells you you don't have any rights, and it's their call to make because they've taken over the control of your child. And they don't feel your child is valuable enough or will have a meaningful enough life or a better or good enough quality of life for them to bother. That's really what it gets down to. And folks, we're there in this country too. Okay? We're there in this country too. I just spoke to a member of the Ohio House of Representatives on Wednesday who has a bill to basically ban abortions on children that are diagnosed with or unborn children that are diagnosed with Down syndrome. And part of the reason she's so passionate about it was because her child in the womb had been diagnosed with some difficulties, and there was some pressure put on them to terminate the pregnancy.
Yes.
You know, the encouragement of, you know, taking the easy way out, quote unquote. And so but we're in there talking to this representative about, well, why do we just stop with Downs? Because there are other fetal abnormalities that are survivable. I mean, obviously, you got the Charlie Gard thing with the mitochondrial DNA issue. You've got what's called trisomy 18, which is Edwards syndrome, and it's much more seriously impactful than Down syndrome is on a child. But I met a young girl this year at the Bringing America Back to Life conference who's now 8 years old who has Edwards syndrome. And although she's in a, you know, in a assisted walker, she can't walk and things, she's a happy girl, and she brings joy to people around her, and her parents love her, and they're providing her care for her, and she is living her quality of life because there are people who care for her. And so why we can't by law protect all of these children is totally staggering to us, to me and to the many of the folks I represent in the pro-life community. You know, we don't want to just pick and choose. We want the Charlie Guards to live. We want the Abigail Butlers to live. We want all of these children to live because it's our presupposition. We believe God is who he says he is. We believe in the truth of his word when he says that we are made in his image after his likeness, and that children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his garden. We were just talking the other day at church, Chuck, with my kids and everybody else, and we were talking about why is abortion wrong? And one of our members of our church said, where does the Bible speak specifically about abortion? And I said, well, there's a number of things in the Old Testament about, you know, if you cause a woman to lose her child that she's carrying, it's a death penalty sentence. I said, but the point is that abortion violates multiple commandments of the Ten. Not just the thou shalt not kill, but the thou shalt not steal, because that's God's heritage you're taking. And the now thou shalt not covet, because usually it's done because it's more convenient to the persons having their own life and pursuing their own pursuits rather than having to sacrifice and provide for a child.
Well, there's also covetousness in there, in that you don't want to be burdened the issue.
Well, yeah, that's right. That's what I was saying.
Yeah.
With coveting. Yeah,
and there's also problems with the image of God. It violates not necessarily the letter, but the spirit of a whole bunch of not just the commandments. Because remember, the commandments are, you know this, and a lot of people don't understand it. If you want to understand Old Testament law, look at the Ten Commandments, because that is simply the shorthand version. Everything in the Ten Commandments, exactly. It's a summation of the whole of the law. Now I'm going to give you something. I took this off GAC, Wikipedia. So you may take it with, okay. You may take
I've never heard of GAC before, but okay. Now I understand what GAC you're talking about.
GAC, GAC Wikipedia. No, if you look up GACWikipedia.com, it won't be there. But this is Edwards syndrome, the prognosis. In 2008 and 2009, 495 diagnoses of Edwards syndrome, trisomy 18, were made in England and Wales, 92% of which were prenatally, in other words, before the child's born, resulting in 339 abortions, 49 stillbirths, so some children are taken by God before they're born in cases of Edwards syndrome, and 72 known unknown outcomes, and 35 live births. Okay, they're taking that particular, you really can't do a statistic when 339 out of 495 are aborted.
Right.
How do you do statistics on that? The answer is,
it's impossible, because you're basically destroying most of your sample.
What we do know is that there were 49 stillbirths, miscarriages, fetal deaths.
So that's about 10% of the overall.
But again, that's not fair, because with 339 having been aborted, you lost that part of your sample.
That's like removing
a huge portion. I mean, like, this is like 2/3 of your sample. And then saying, well, but only 10%. Were actual failures. You don't know that. You don't know anything. You've removed most of your sample from the statistical analysis, making it meaningless. You can't tell anything from that. So basically, what is the prognosis? Well, we'd have to go pre-abortion, and their Edwards syndrome hasn't been known all that long. I mean, it's been known, but they didn't know what, you know, they weren't keeping real close track of it. So, nobody knows for sure. half the infants with this condition do not survive beyond the first week of life. It's a pretty serious genetic anomaly, but the kids who do survive end up like, you know, hopefully like this little girl whose parents take care of her, and she's happy. And is she totally healthy? Well, probably not. They have heart insufficiency, and they have serious physical, serious physical problems. Just like a lot of other trisomy issues, like trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome. All you have to do, if you want to see some very high-functioning Down syndrome survivors, and by what I mean by survivors is we are and have been mostly aborting Down syndrome children for decades now.
Right. Yes.
But if you want to see some
90% abortion rate.
Right. If you want to see some very high-functioning Down syndrome cases, look at, there's a thing on A&E Network called Born This Way. And it's sort of a reality show, and it's a reality show that's based on these trisomy 21s, Down syndrome cases. And now there are some who do not function at this level. Let's be realistic about this. There are some who are profoundly retarded. Some of these young people on this show actually are functioning pretty close to normal intelligence. In other words, IQ of around 100. One of the markers is below average intelligence, if you will, among other things. I mean, you recognize the facial features and the bodily features. They tend to have, their bodies are a little different than people with no genetic anomalies and that kind of thing. Same thing with trisomy 18. They have head shape abnormalities and bone abnormalities and abnormalities with their extremities and that kind of thing. Look, that's they still bear the image of God. Flat out. And it's frightening to think about the idea that we would kill them just because they're different. That being said, I know we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left, and we want to get into why national health care is a bad idea and what's being done about it in the United States Congress. So we probably ought to segue over there, Barry, if we're
going
to touch it.
Right now, nothing's being done about it in the United States Congress.
We can get 7 minutes out of nothing, though, I think, because of the way nothing is being done. Because let's face it.
That's right. Well, you know, earlier on, I had mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of hurry up and stop. And it's funny how Ohio is playing in that particular arena about Obamacare, because the United States Senate and of course, we need to go ahead and put out there our condolences Senator John McCain and his family, who was just diagnosed this week with a brain tumor. Went in for a procedure, and Mitch McConnell in the Senate had to postpone the potential vote on their Obamacare replacement plan because of Senator McCain's health issue. Well, then it turned come to find out afterwards that it was much more serious than what was initially reported, and it turned out that, you know, you and I talked about this offline, that when we heard that they removed a 2-inch blood clot from above his eyebrow, you immediately realized, yeah, that's probably thrown by a tumor.
Yep.
And that's probably going to be the next thing that happens. And so Chuck wins the crystal ball award on that one, because he nailed it right. I mean, this is what's happening, and this is a type of very malignant and aggressive tumor that people in John McCain's age bracket, there's only a 4% survivability rate normally. So we know that Senator McCain's a fighter from all the times we've seen him fight against us on various issues, and I'm sure he'll fight against this just as strongly. So, we're going to send condolences, but that puts McConnell in a pickle, because there aren't, all it takes is two or three, and this time it's four, and we have a gang of four now, ladies and gentlemen, who have basically told McConnell that they will not vote for repeal. And funny thing is, Chuck, Ohio's playing prominently in this, because one of those four United States senators is Ohio's own Rob Portman. Now, it's also interesting because one of the other four senators is from Colorado. And if people remember back just a little bit, we've talked about how the governor of Ohio, John Kasich, was actually creating a little group with the governor of Colorado, the Democrat governor, John Hickenlooper. in order to try to get Congress to not repeal Obamacare and not roll back the Medicaid expansion money coming to the states because, well, both men have basically put their entire political eggs in that one basket. And in John Kasich's case, and we know for sure, has basically balanced his budget, which is going to be coming way out of balance as soon as Congress acts, on this Medicaid expansion money. Just like he did when he was in Congress, when he pushed stuff offline and pushed payments out and called it a balanced budget. That's what he's been doing in Ohio, and it's chickens are going to come home to roost here. And so Rob Portman, who was a never-Trumper and was behind Kasich and is part of that establishment power structure here in Ohio, has now come out when before he was holding his cards close to the vest and really not saying where he was going to be. But now he's come out with he and I forget who the Colorado senator is. I should have looked that up. But Olympia Snowe and also Shelley Moore Capito, the senator from West Virginia. Those four have come out now, and they represent a big enough block, Chuck, that Mitch McConnell can't get a bill through on Obamacare repeal. So,
well, okay,
Ohio's Republican senator, our only Republican senator, basically being the instrument of strapping Ohio's economy to this dying albatross called Obamacare.
Yeah.
And we will go down with it, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm sure we will.
Don't kid yourselves.
Let's be clear about what Mitch McConnell was trying to do. He wasn't trying to repeal Obamacare. What he was trying to do was remake it from the inside. Remember,
right? I said his replacement, not his repeal.
I think you did say repeal, but if you didn't, then my apologies.
That's fine. And either way, but the point is,
yeah,
when the replacement plan failed to be brought up for a vote,
yep,
the House started pushing for their repeal version and. Or the original repeal version, which these senators, Portman, Capito, et cetera, I don't think Snowe did, but all these other senators voted in favor of when Obama was president.
And that's easy to explain because they knew it was going nowhere.
Right.
It was a cheap show vote, bottom line. Cheap show vote.
That's one where you can vote, quote unquote, the right way, knowing you'll never have to actually be called to account for it because somebody, either the other chamber or the president, will bail you out by vetoing it or killing it. That way you can go home and campaign on how many times you voted to kill Obamacare. Thank you, Congressman Pat Teaberry, who also is part of this obstructionist crowd.
Yep.
Not publicly, but let's just tell you the truth.
He's in there. Yeah. Basically, Barry, it just proves, look, people were critical of us because we said, don't vote for Rob Portman. You're not going to get what you think you're going to get. And, look, it's our only choice, blah, 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 blah. No, it wasn't your only choice. There were third-party people available who were much better than Rob Portman. But, you know, Republicans won't do that. Oh, no, we got to support the guy. And look what you got. And we did the same thing with Kasich. We said, you're not going to get what you think you're going to get. Oh, no, he's going to be the guy. He's going to be good for our policies, blah, blah, blah. Where has he gotten us? If you'll recall, when he was running for re-election for governor, we have to repeal Obamacare. And now it's like we have to not repeal Obamacare. So that's where we are.
Well, and again, this is a situation where I think a lot of folks need to contact their United States senator and say, you know what, enough's enough. We know you think you're protected because you just ran and won last cycle. Let's go ahead and get the pressure on Rob Portman and others. And honestly, there probably won't be a repeal happen because these guys are too worried about getting beat up back home when it comes to reelection time. And that's the problem. You know, Chuck, and we've said this over and over again. It's like that old saying by Dabney about how conservatism just chases after progressivism and accedes to the innovation, but they want to wait a little while until things settle down before they just basically adopt it and call that the new conservatism.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why we keep inexorably shuffling and sliding, or as Robert Bork said, slouching toward Gomorrah.
So I'm going to sum up because we're out of time. Essentially, what's probably going to happen is there will not be a repeal. The whole system will collapse, and the calls will then be for a single-party pay system. And Republicans, unfortunately, being not very smart about this, will acquiesce. We will end up with a single-party pay. Welcome to Great Britain, folks. That's the system we will have. Well, that being said, we are out of time. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.